Well, good morning again. Welcome. Thanks for staying with us. My name is Eugenio Pace. I'm a PM in the Patents and Practices team in the cloud program. So most of our what we do in the Windows Azure platform space, you know, comes from our team. This is my friend and colleague, Scott, our dev lead in the team.
I'm the better looking one.
We'll see that.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess a third of you at least were here on Monday for the Windows Azure workshop. So, you know, that will, you know, there we touched on a lot of the things that we are going to cover today as well. But today's session is most around the second guide, which is a developing applications for the cloud, the second guide that we published, which is more like a greenfield scenario. It's more like an environment where we don't have any constraints and we don't have any legacy to be worried about. So it's not a migration scenario, which was the topic for the workshop. This is building an application for Windows Azure. I'm also very happy that you guys had a good, very good introduction in the morning with Youssef on what Windows Azure is, kind of the strategy and all of that. So what I will do is just very quickly glance over a couple of slides just to level set again and bring back again some of the key concepts that we are going to use in the rest of the session, right? Which is pretty hands-on, and we're going to go through a concrete example, right? So Windows Azure Platform is all that thing that is in this slide that I'm not going to read, right? See, these are properties in reality from any cloud computing platform, right? But Windows Azure in itself, it's also a cloud computing platform, so it kind of agrees with all these attributes that you see listed there, all right? The two most important things to remember, if you want, only two things from Windows Azure Platform is that it's a platform, right? So by itself, it doesn't do much, anything useful. You have to build an application to make the most of it. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, that it's Windows, right? So everything you know about Windows Server 2008, to be more specific, you know, pretty much applies to Windows Azure, right? So anything that runs on Windows Server, you know, has a good chance of running in Windows Azure and will have even a better chance of running on Windows Azure in the future, right? So what we have, you saw this, I love the diskette to symbolize the massive storage system that we have, right? So we have Windows Azure itself, which is the OS, we have compute resources, we have storage resources, and we have a way of interacting with that environment to provision new resources, to deprovision resources when we don't need them anymore, and to monitor how things are working in general, right? So that's kind of the lowest level here in the stack. We have something else called SQL Azure, which is a database, a relational database. More specifically, is SQL Server run by Microsoft, hosted in Windows Azure data centers, right? But it's a relational, from a relational database. From a programming perspective, from an API perspective, it's TDS, right? Port 1433, and whatever, you know, you send to a SQL Server today, you send it to SQL Azure, it's likely that it will work. It's 90% of SQL Server today. And then the last piece today, you know, all these boxes, all these blue boxes are production services you can use for production applications. We have the Windows Azure App Fabric, which is it has two services in it. One is a service bus, which is a connectivity service, something that allows you to send messages back and forth with different messaging patterns, very common messaging patterns like streaming, request response, more like document exchange or eventing, you know, things like that. And we have something called Access Control Service, which is a very interesting piece in our platform, which is essentially a hosted STS, right? So it's a security token service as a service, if you want. Something that can give you tokens, security tokens in exchange for something, right? Credentials or certificates, some proof that you bring to it. All of these pieces are all independent of each other in most cases, right? So you can only use storage, you can only use SQL, and you can mix and match in your app in the ways you see fit. And of course, all of that is available with the seven properties that I enumerated before, right? It's self-service, on-demand, pay-as-you-go, globally available, elastic, etc., right? So From the compute side, we have four types of machines: small, medium, large, and extra large, which translate roughly to equivalent cores, right? So you have bigger machines for more data processing intensive workloads, and you have like smaller machines, and maybe you can have many of those for more like lightweight, interactive workloads, right? And we have, regardless of the power of the machines, we have four types of, two roles, we call roles. One role that comes with IIS and another role that comes with nothing. And you are responsible for, you know, installing whatever you want, right? And we will see these two guys in action in a little bit. From a storage perspective, we have Windows Azure Storage itself, which comes in four types. We have blobs, which are appropriate to store things like videos and pictures and documents and JSON serialized objects, things like that. We have tables, which can be seen as collections of entities with properties without any particular schema. So each entity, each row, if you want, in this table can have any number of columns, even if we had columns, right? So that's the second type of storage that we have in Windows Azure Storage. The third one is queues, which are just data queues, asynchronous, reliable messaging systems, something that allows you to send messages and forget about that. If you successfully stored a message in a data queue, in a Windows Azure queue, it will be kept there with the same availability and the same resilience and the rest of the storage subsystems. There's a fourth thing which I forgot to add in this slide, which is Azure Drives, which are simply NTFS volumes built on top of blobs. Okay? And the last thing from a state perspective, we have SQL Azure, which I already told you is pretty much SQL Server. All Windows Azure Storage is accessible with a REST API. There is also a client that ships with the Windows Azure SDK, which allows, if you're in the .NET world, it's just pretty much a domain model on over these things and encapsulate all the, build the HTTP request and get the HTTP response from those endpoints for you. But if you want to program against with core raw HTTP, you would use those. For SQL Azure, you would use TDS, right? So with that, that's the very quick refresher on Windows Azure platform. What we're going to do now is we're going to take one kind of case study, which is the case study that we used in the developing for Windows Azure guide. And the scenario is kind of illustrated in this slide. We have three main actors. We have the guy on top, which is Tailspin. And Tailspin is an ISV. It's a service provider. It's the builder of the app, right? And this particular app is Tailspin Surveys. It's a surveys application. So it's being able to answer surveys online, right? That's kind of the idea. So Tailspin wants to host, in our fictitious example, it's a small company, maybe a startup. They don't want to invest in all the pitch around not investing in capital to get all the infrastructure that they need to deploy the service. All that applies. They're a pretty savvy development team anyway, so we built Tailspin in ways we consider good ways of building an app, right? So we are using TDD, we are using all the latest and greatest from Microsoft, we're using MVC 2.0, we're using .NET 4.0, we're using the latest SDK from Windows Azure, all of that, all right? So that's Tailspin and the service. There's two other actors in the scenario. There is subscribers to the survey, right, which is these companies here on my right. So these are the large companies, medium companies, smaller companies. These are the people who will buy a subscription to Tailspin surveys and then will author and publish surveys for people to complete, right? So notice that there is a wide range of types of customers that Tailspin is targeting with this, right? Whether you're working from home or whether you are a big, large corporation, they want to sell Tailspin surveys to both of them anyway. The last actor in the scenario is the people who are completing the surveys, which are the bunch of guys there on the left. And those are the people who are actually completing the questionnaires that are authored by the companies on the right. All right? So the reason we build we came up with this scenario, is because it brings up a number of interesting questions and a number of interesting, you know, challenges, if you want, how to build such a thing, right? So there's, first of all, the notion of multi-tenancy, right? Because, you know, this is a system that will be used by multiple subscribers. And how do we deal with that, right? We're dealing with subscribers of different sizes and types and requirements, right? It's likely that someone, like a large subscriber, will have some infrastructure and premises that they want to leverage, right? And we will see what that looks like. And on the opposite side, a small company or someone working from home that must still author surveys, you know, they might not have any infrastructure besides a notebook. And what does it mean from that perspective? Also, it is likely that, if Tailspin is very successful, they may have, you know, a couple hundred thousands, tens of thousands of subscribers. But it is very likely that it will be potentially millions of people answering these surveys, because the people answering the surveys are not Tailspin customers, are customers of their customers, right? So you can think of, you know, the large subscriber can be a big supermarket and they put or a retailer or something like that, and they put the survey out for everybody to see on Christmas or something like that. It is very likely that at point in time there will be a large number of people all coming together in a short period of time trying to answer questions published there. Okay, so that's kind of the setting for what we are going to talk in the rest of the session. Did I forget something?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. So let's start by taking a look at Tailspin surveys.
Tailspin surveys. All right. So Tailspin, great design site. But we have these big enterprises that subscribe to Tailspin. And you can see up at the top, we are at HTTPS Tailspin Cloud App, this Tailspin demo cloudapp.net. If you've ever worked with Azure, everything is cloudapp.net, but you can use your own DNS to rename that. We didn't. This is actually running in the cloud, so that's why I've kind of shown you this. We're going to go into 8.8.m. You'll notice that we are kind of moved to this other URL that is this tailspin-issuers.cloudapp.net. And what that's doing is we said, all right, and I'll take you through a little bit in the demo, is we want 8.8.m to own their own STS. Now, if you were here Monday, we talked a lot about STS, and if you heard this morning's talk, we'll talk about federated identity, things like that. So that's what we've done. We're simulating this. But we're just saying that somebody who's logging in as an 8.8.m user is logging in from, is going to be authenticated somewhere else. Tailspin is not going to get in the middle of authentication. They're like, I really don't want to deal with authentication. That's a hard problem for us to solve. But if you tell us where to send people, we'll authenticate them. We could have done something with ACS and like OpenID or Facebook or something else like that. But this is just our simulated issuer. And we'll go in and continue in. And when you come in, you saw we get the sign and response. We come back. We have all these lists of surveys that you can kind of see. But we'll zoom in here. So you can see we have lists of surveys. We have all these demos. We have where it's been created on, we can analyze it, things like that. But you can go and create new surveys. We can create a little test survey. You can add questions to it. We have different question types. We have voice, picture. When you're here tomorrow to see the phone demo app, you'll see all this as well. Multiple choice. You can say, what is your favorite color? Red, blue, or green. We can add that to the survey. We can create this survey. And of course, now we've got this survey. So if we go off and we can see that what we do this, we'll open this link in a new tab. You also see we talked a little bit about where that we had these two different sites, or we talked about the fact that we could have potentially a lot of subscribers, but millions of people, we hope millions of people taking surveys, we actually set up two different sites. One of the reason for doing that is now I can kind of scale my workload. You can imagine I don't need a huge number of boxes to manage for my subscribers, but I might need a huge number of boxes to manage for people taking surveys. So the public-facing site, the HTTP 80, that you could take this URL and give out, is going to be able to say, all right, I'm going to send you out and get you this survey, and it's going to go to one website, whereas people who are analyzing surveys are going to a completely different website. And we'll see more of that in the code when we show it to you. So I'm going to go out and say my favorite color is red. For those that know me, they know why. So I took the survey, I got a thank you page, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happening behind the scenes, but basically we've submitted the survey, done, and hopefully get great responses. And we can go in and see now, if I go and analyze this survey, I can see that somebody has already answered green as well. Thank you very much. I expect you, if you just wait, you get to go, you're going to get some great, you get to take your own survey later. And we'll look at the responses at the end. But you can see that I can go in, we have this little being about how many, we've had two answers, 50% said, one person said red, one person said green. We can actually go in and browse through the responses. So we have red and green. And another thing that we could do, and we're not going to do this now, but another thing that you could do is when you build Azure applications, don't think that you're limited. So, and we'll talk a little bit about when we go through the code, but you're not limited to using just tables, just blobs, just queues, just any of the, or just, SQL Server, or SQL Azure, pardon me. You can actually use all these things together. And actually, in this application, we are. So we're saying here, and I'm not going to do it here because we don't have it hooked up to the SQL Azure on Azure, but we do if you run it locally. You can actually export this data out to SQL Azure. So one of the things you might want to do is you might want to give, like you have subscriptions, you may have different tiers of subscriptions, and you say, oh, I want, Tailspin says, by the way, if you are willing to pay a few dollars more, we'll let you have access to your data in SQL Azure. So you can connect to it through Excel, do all kinds of crazy manipulations on it, do whatever you want to with it, but we don't have to get involved with it, or even export it out to your own database. You can have access to it. And this is what this allows you to do. I can then take all that data that we store in blobs and tables and put it into a relational model in SQL Azure that's much easier to kind of analyze for the enterprise customers or the person sitting at home. So the other thing you can do is I can go over here and look at my account. This is kind of very dummied up, where this configuration basically says, let me zoom in here so that you can actually see some of this. This would be your sign-in URL. This is basically saying this is, you see that it says HTTP localhost. This you could, when you sign up for Tailspin, you could tell us all this information. You could tell Tailspin, hey, this is, I want my host to be anywhere in the U.S. This is back to this totally global available. So when Tailspin deploys your application, they say, oh, I want this in Europe. All your customers are in Europe. Well, I'll put one in Europe for you. Or I put it anywhere in the U.S. I also want to have this sign-in URL. This is where my STS lives. This is my thumbprint for my STS and the claim type, so that when you come back and actually validate that the claim comes back and I can take a claim from your STS and turn it into something that Tailspin can use, I can use this thumbprint to make sure that it's digitally signed with that thumbprint coming back from, Adatum or Fabricam or whoever else that wants to be. This is also your SQL Azure instance that we set up for you, and that you can have, this is locally against SQL Express, but your SQL Azure instance that we would hook up for you that would then allow you to export that data out. And then the last thing, is I can go in and delete my surveys, because, I may have the one that goes for Christmas, and after Christmas I'm no longer want to use that survey at all. So any questions about that? That is the application.
Great.
I'll let you go back.
So as you can see, we are not experts in surveys, right? It's a very, very simple application. But even this simple application raises some interesting dimensions, which are the things that we want to talk about in the guide, right? The separation of scalability requirements, right? The users on one side, the authors on one side, and other dimensions which we will we will go and see in a few slides. So we put together this survey for you. That's a URL. If you go to Tailspin demo cloudapp.net survey, Adatum, which is our fake tenant symposium, that's a published survey that you guys can go and complete, right? You get that?
Oh, wait a minute. Go back. Because we're going to show the results at the end.
We want to take the survey.
And then we're going to give it to Don.
Yes. And then we'll look at the IP address of you. And
yeah, we'll find you. We all know you're sitting in the room.
All right. Are we good? So the first thing that you saw is this identity aspect of the application architecture. We think of identity and single sign-on and the kind of experience that you saw in the demo from a user experience perspective, which is a great perspective to have anyway, right? So Adatum employee, which is what Scott was doing during the demo, he's working in Adatum. It is very likely that they already have some identity in this big corporation, right? They might have an Active Directory, and they definitely do not want another username and password. It might be even, non-compliant with some of the governance regulations inside that organization to have this random username and password, and do not control the life cycle of that employee, right? So if you fire the employee, he might go home and still have access to Tailspin surveys, right? And you don't want that. The other thing is that, in a way, Tailspin wants to eliminate any barriers of adoption for their service, right? In this case, if you already have infrastructure, you can just join can leverage all of that, right? But there's another angle to identity, more advanced identity management like the ones you see here, which is not the pure user experience one, which is, again, very, very important. But it's more like this is a session about scalability and reliability and high availability, right? And the thing is that when you take the responsibility of authenticating your users, guess what? Authentication is a bottleneck for pretty much everything you do, right? If you cannot authenticate, if the authentication module in your system goes down, nothing works, nothing. Right? So by using an approach where you rely on somebody else's infrastructure to do the authentication for you, you're not only making your user experience better, you're also increasing the reliability of your system because we're not more responsible for dealing with that anymore, right? So formally, what we are using is it's claims-based identity. We went through this in much more details on Monday. We have a full book that you all got on this subject and how to implement this. The good news is that we have, Microsoft has products and frameworks and services that make this approach really, really, really easy compared to what it was like 1 or 2 years ago, right? So creating this, what you saw here, like in this diagram, you see Adatum with its own identity provider that in our example is simulated, right? We don't have a real one, but it would be their Active Directory. And then we will have the Tailspin side just trusting tokens issued by that authority, right? So that's kind of the approach that we're using. A variation of this, which is pretty interesting as well, is by using, instead of using like the customer directly, the customer identity provider directly, is using something like the access control service, which is a hosted SDS, right? And the good thing about ACS, it comes pre-provisioned with very common, popular, and well-known identity providers like the ones that you have over there, right? Which means that automatically, Tailspin can offer their customers, right, authentication with their Facebook account, their Google account, their Live ID, and what have you, right? Which means that an example, kind of an extreme of the spectrum, if it's someone working from home, it is very likely that they will not have an Active Directory installed, under the desk. But it's very likely that they will have one of these identities already, right? So, and again, we are not only providing a much better user experience, much better user, one less username and password to remember. But also, we are decreasing reliability, and we are increasing the availability of the entire system because authentication happens somewhere else. All right? And again, just to reiterate, this is something that was very, very hard to do in the past. Today, it is really, really much simpler than it was. Right? We have the contents, we have WIF, we have ADFS, we have ACS, combination of on-premises products, services, and tools to make this really, really compelling. Bottom line, there's no excuses for bad authentication in your systems, right? You have the tools to really create compelling architectures around this. Good? Can I take this one?
Sure. So in your web application, everybody know what a CDN is, I hope? You may have heard of like Akamai, things like that, where you can kind of take your static content and give it a time to live, and they will cache that for you. So you can imagine this whole idea of scalability. I don't want every time somebody coming to, you know, to my server living in the United States from Asia, maybe I want to push that out to all these nodes so that it can be done. So, for example, like we push out jQuery and the AJAX toolkit and all that stuff to a CDN so that you guys, so whenever you publish your application, wherever somebody's living, that can be downloaded offline from your, not from your server. So you can imagine we have these things called blobs, and a little bit of technical differences. Tables and blobs, even though they're, you know, you can expose them, table information out to the world because it's all REST-based. Blobs are a little bit REST-based, but they also support all the regular verbs. So it's just a get and a post. So if I want to get something from a blob, I can just issue out that URL, and that's a straight get from that blob. There's no REST, you know, no going through WCF data services or anything like that to actually get to that blob information. So that's why it's good for that static content. And because you can put that static content into these blobs, you can take your blob and publish it to the CDN.
So before we go there, just back to the previous, you know, this is a traditional approach of building a website. Right. You always go through your web servers, right? Even to get the content of different types, like images or documents or pictures or videos or whatever, right? That's what you see here is like the standard architecture of, you know, that we've been using for a while. With Windows Azure, you can do things slightly different, which is what comes next.
Right. So now I can take this image or static content or do anything I want to with it and put it out to a blob, and then take that blob and publish it out to a CDN. So Azure includes this CDN. I think there's how many?
So we have six locations. Windows Azure itself, right, all around the world. But there's 24.
22.
That's outdated. There's 24
outdated.
Additional locations around the world with CDN capabilities, right? Which is these caching capabilities.
So now that I have that, I can then take that image and push that out to the CDN anywhere, and that way, whenever someone gets that URL, I can get that from any CDN worldwide. And basically, it's as simple. And I'll show you, I'm going to actually show you the portal here in a bit. It's as easy as going in, saying, I want to publish this content to the CDN. Bang, done. And it goes out to all the CDNs, and you can give it a time to live and things like that.
So something as simple as getting your URLs for this static content or this content, you know, outside of your web traffic, it could have a huge impact from a scalability perspective, because if you are offloading all of that from your traffic on your websites to the infrastructure itself, right? And in CDN, it's as Scott said, it's like a click away on the portal. You don't have to do anything special, you know, or terribly special to enable something like that.
Right. And so I just want to show you a little bit. In our application, we allow the people to upload their own image of what they want to see. So I've done this on Fabricam. So I'm going to go log in to Fabricam. And you'll see that this image sits up here that is different. It's not the Tailspin image anymore. It's the Fabricam image. So let's go. We can expect this element. And I'm going to zoom in down here. And you can see that this guy comes from tailspin.demo.blob.core.windows.net. this big long path. But basically, that's the path, the URL path, to that image in blob storage. Now, we don't have anything published out on the CDN, but given that, given this path, this logos WP7, and if I wanted to, I could take that container, and I'll show you what that means by that, for these blobs, and publish that out to the CDN. And then anything that goes into that container for any blobs, if I put a picture, static content, anything that goes in there gets published out to the CDN. And I can set timeouts and all those things. You can do that through code or through the website, how long the time to live on those things are. I think by default it's 72 hours. That may have changed since the last time. But you can see that now I can now kind of offload a lot of the static content onto this. So you can put a lot of information into your blob storage, so you're not thinking about just putting it on your website. I may want to have, and because these things are addressable by URLs, I can put these things anywhere.
And this is not just to close on this one. This is a very small trick, but again, could have a strong impact in the, you know, how your application scales and how your application behaves. Pictures and images and static things are very common content types that you would put in here, right? But you're not limited to that. It could be anything. We have applications and we have customers where they generate actually fragments of the website there. So the entire web page is not just delivered through the web server, but you can have like JSON serialized objects right on blob storage that you grab, and through things like jQuery or client side scripting, you know, take that and, you know, enrich the experience, all offloading the traffic on the website. So I'm gonna start. So this is it's almost obvious, but, you know, it's important to reinforce. Like the survey example is a perfect example of applying this pattern, right? So you saw in the demo that, you know, when you created a survey, then you published the URL, then somebody completed the survey, and then you could go back and analyze the results of those survey. By this delayed processing, what we mean is that we have decoupled the processing and the analysis of the survey results from the act of submitting the results itself, right? So for example, what you see here in black, it's actually the experience of someone filling in, you know, the questionnaire, right? So completing a survey. So you get a survey, you fill all the questions, all the checkboxes, etc., and then you submit that, right? And you want that time, the blue time there, from the time you say post until the time you get the thank you note, to be as fast as possible from a user. So one option would be to take the survey result from posted from the website and then look at that and then try to update everything behind the scenes, right, to reflect that new answer, right? So there might be changing in the averages, changing the results, changing all of that. Instead of doing that, because remember, we can have potentially millions of people answering this at the same time, you know, we will be clogging all the back end of this. What we're doing is we're storing that thing somewhere, and then asynchronously we're picking up that piece of information and we are processing it, you know, completely decoupled from the posting itself, right? Very, very simple. This is a pattern that's been used for ages in one way or the other, right? And the good news is that in Windows Azure, it is fairly straightforward to implement, and there's actually built-in mechanisms and built-in components to make this really, really easy to do. So in our case, I think we're generating a blob with the results. So we take the results, we serialize the results into a JSON object, we put that in a blob, and because it's forward only, write once, right, there's no edits or anything in this case, it's append only. That's a very, very, very quick operation. And then we have a worker role in the background picking up those unprocessed blobs, right, and turning all the, running all the algorithms and all the computation to calculate the results of that, right? And there's different types of calculations that we do. There's calculations that require going to the entire data set again. There's calculations that do not, are incremental. So I think we show a little bit of both,
yep.
Right? That's obviously highly dependent on the type of things that you're doing. But in our case, we show a little bit of both. Things are required to revisit the entire data set, have historical, take the historical data into account, and things that can be just incremental to what you have done, right? So that's a very, very basic pattern that we have implemented. And as I said, you know, Windows Azure has built-in mechanisms to do this. The built-in mechanisms are the queues, the blobs itself, which leads us to kind of the fundamental pattern that you will see in every Windows Azure-based application, right? Which is a number of instances which are front-end, interactive things that take work, right? There's a common storage, which is shared, and then there's a communication mechanism between the front-end and the back-end processing, which is the worker roles over there. And of course, you can turn on and turn off the, you know, one and the other as you see fit, right? Who knows? Maybe Tailspin can sell the, you know, near real-time results as a value add and then spin up more workers and kind of like stretching the sample a little bit. But it could apply in other situations, right? And therefore, they can spin up more instances that they can charge back to the tenant. And in other cases, you might say, well, this runs, you know, at the end of the day. We collect everything, and at the end of the day, we turn one, run everything, and you see the results. Which leads us to another thing, which is it's a very common kind of pitfall in Windows Azure, if you want, which is we have this notion of worker roles, right? These things that take work in the background, and they are running, and you know it's a generic thing. The reality is that the only difference between worker roles and web roles is that one has IIS and the other one doesn't. So if you install IIS in a worker role, it becomes a web role, right? But I think the original intent was to differentiate these things that are background processes, which is worker, and from interactive processes. It is very likely, so coming back to the pitfall, is that it is very likely that you will have more than one task, right, in your, more than one background process to do in your environments, right? So in Tailspin, we have at least two or three, right?
Two or three, yeah.
So one of them is the one that calculates all the statistics or the analysis from the results, right? That's one. That's one type of task. And it's triggered by the presence of a new survey in the system. Right? Whenever there's a new survey, that thing gets started. There's another one, which is the task that takes a snapshot of your non-SQL storage and dumps all that information into a relational model for analysis. You saw that, you know, in our model we have a hybrid data model, right? We have SQL and we have non-SQL storage. The guy who translates from one to the other, or transfer data from one to the other, is another worker role, or is another background process that started when the customer goes and says, yeah, I want to take all the results of this survey for analysis, for further analysis beyond of what Tailspin gives me, right? And that's another task. And the question is, do we have two worker roles for this, or we have one worker role doing the two things? The most common or the natural thing that people do is that they create one worker role for one and the other worker role for the other, not realizing maybe, or maybe now they do realize, now that they're getting bills, that you have to pay for each of those, right? Even if maybe transferring data only happens, you know, once a week, you know, statistically, or every once in a while analysis and running analysis happens more often, right? So a very common pattern that we are using here is this notion of creating like a finer grained notion of a background process, which today, unfortunately, doesn't come in the SDK itself, right? So it's something that you need to build. And it's something that we built in Tailspin surveys and in our samples, right? So it's this notion that we can create a task which can be triggered by different conditions, like time, and would be more like a scheduled task, or it could be a task that can be triggered by the presence of a message on a queue, for example, right? So those are conditions that initiate the task itself. But in reality, these are just things that are running on its own thread inside the same worker role, which is what you see in the upper left corner, right? Now, the good thing is that you can make the second, right? You can have just one worker. If you really have a very heavyweight process, you can just have one and one-to-one mapping between workers and tasks. But the approach that we're using is more general and gives you much more flexibility, because at the end of the day, what you want is for this worker to be 99% CPU all the time, right? As much as possible. It could be smoking, the better. The more smoking it is, the better. So we're going to show you
show you a little bit of code. So one of the things also that you'll notice is worker roles are, how many people have played with Azure, done worker roles? All right, all of you, great. The idea of a worker role is like programming in Windows in the way, way back beginning. It's just a run loop. So the worker role, when you fire it up, if you ever played with it, if you ever created a project, it'll create this while loop, and it says, while true, do some work. And you'll want to do that, because if you don't, the thing will do the work, and then it'll stop. So here, let's go look at our worker role. Like, so if you were here on Monday, you saw that when you fire up a worker role or web role, they have these things called role entry points. And this is the way you can say, this is what I want to do on start, this is what I want to do when it, this is what I want to do with a run, and this is what I want to do when the on stop. So ignoring the on start piece, which is just a bunch of setup, this is the run method. So you can see, here's what it's doing. I'm just going to sleep, and then I'll wake up and do some more work. But what we're really doing is these two things. We have these things called queue handlers. This is stuff that we built that basically deal with this kind of pattern that we talked about before, which is when something happens in that website, when you actually take the survey, we take that survey, we serialize it to a blob, a JSON, and sort in a blob, and then we put a message on a queue. If you heard Monday, the reason that we do that, and you may say, well, why don't you just put the whole message on the queue? Well, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked. The reason that we don't do that is because your queue message, just this is the tips and tricks section, your message size is limited to 8K. In reality, it's 6K because they base64 encode everything, and you probably won't, if you go over 6K, you're probably going to breach that 8K limit because of the base64 encoding. So what we do, they call this kind of this golden ticket pattern, which I'll put a message on a queue, I'll actually have a pointer back to my blob that we actually are referring to for that particular message, and then once these workers start, they just kind of monitor. The reason it's called a queue handler is because they monitor these queues and they handle the things that happen. We also have this thing called a command, and we have two different types. We have a batch command. The reason we have a batch command is because we want to add a little bit of pre and post processing on this queue handler. But if you look at it, it's pretty simple. Let's look at the batch processing one. This is the actual one that handles analyzing the surveys, taking that data, and pushing it and writing it all the way through. One of the reasons I think that it may have not been clear, but reason we do this, and for scalability reasons, writing once and reading once is a good idea. Like, I want to not have my reads and writes coming from the same place. So what I want to do is a write once only so that I can read many times. So what we're doing is we're saying, we start here, we do a bunch of analytics, and we push some more stuff over here. You may think of this like a MapReduce type things. And we do a bunch, and we push it over here, and then we actually get all the results, and we push it into a blob at the very end that the application reads from. So all this data comes from one place. So while we're munging and manipulating the data, because those gets are just happening over here on the read, because it's a near real-time update, these things are reading from this. We don't actually have to do any locking or contention or anything like that until we actually write the new version out that the application will read. So I write all the way through this one time, through this big, analytics. We don't do a whole lot of analytics, but then I can write that once, and then multiple reads happen on that guy at the end. And that way I get much more scalability because I don't have to do any locking or there's any contention there. So if we look at this batch handler, this is just a bunch of Fluent API stuff that we added on top of it. But basically, you'll also notice, if you play around with this application, we did this TDD. We added a bunch of kind of wrappers around all the Azure storage pieces because they're not very TDD friendly if you don't want to be going against storage all the time. You can do it, but you always have to have your dev fabric running, and that becomes a pain, and plus you have to figure out how do I put data in and all those other good things. It's no different from any other kind of TDD database testing, but we wanted to be able to test this without having to actually go to a real queue so we can mock these things out. So we have this iAzure queue, which is just really backed by an Azure queue that then handles this queue and then says, for this queue, we're basically going to run a command, and I'll show you this command, and we'll actually do some, and you'll see down here that all we're doing is using the TPL. We're just starting a new task, and then while true, we're going to cycle through this command. And this cycle command just goes in and says, all right, get the last 32 messages. You remember we talked on Monday, if you were here, we talked about getting things in a batch. 32 messages is the limit, just by the way. I want to grab 32 messages off the queue, and I want to process them. And I'm going to run each of these messages on this command. Now, the great thing about messages, and you may say, wow, what happens if the whole thing dies in the middle? Another great question for you guys. If you do that, what happens? These messages actually have a kind of invisibility timeout on them. If you grab a message off the queue, it becomes invisible for a length of time, and you can specify that. And then no other person can get it. Because what if I have like 40 of these instances running? I grab 32 messages, the next guy grabs 32 messages. Well, he's not going to see the 32 messages I got because those guys are all invisible now. Done, gone. He can't see them. But if I die after the 16th message, and let's say you can see I'm processing these, and then I'll actually delete them after I delete each message as I'm done with it. If I only get through 16 and I don't delete the other messages, well, guess what? The next guy that comes along, when the timeout comes off, he will pick those guys up. So you can see that we just run through these, we process the message, and then we process the message from this, the messages from this queue, and we then call this batch command run. So if you just see this command interface, it just has a run for a message queue. And all he's doing is saying, all right, for every message, run whatever code needs to happen. And it's not a very interesting code, but basically he's taking that message and he's saying, well, where is this data on the queue? I then go and look at all my other statistical data. I grab all that. I then update all that data, and then eventually I write it back out to the end result, which is the thing the application reads that shows you the analytics, which we saw. If we looked at our little test message, we saw that when I submitted red, it went through and said, oh, I go do all this, and they updated to say that, you know, there's been two people that have answered the surveys, probably about 12 by now, have answered the survey, and 50%, it's a 50-50 ratio. Two people answered it, one person said red, one person said green. Does that make sense? Yes, no, maybe so. Okay.
So even though you see that these libraries and these APIs, it's under the Tailspin namespace, right? So this is part of the sample that we ship with the developing applications for the cloud guide, right? All this is kind of generic code, right? You can take these and you could take these almost as an application block in the traditional sense. Even we didn't do that work yet because we haven't spent any cycles on, you know, factoring on all that out in its own reusable piece. But what I'm saying, actually, we are also working in getting this, you know, into the standard SDK that will come with Windows Azure. Now, you can do that on your own. And in fact, there's a lot of little bit nuggets of good practices implemented in this library, right? Like, getting messages in batch is a very good idea. It's cheaper, it's faster, it's more efficient, right? But there's a few other things, right? Another common pattern is, you know, that really you don't wake up when there's a message in the queue, right? It's not like you're listening on the queue and then you're blocking on the read. You read and say, do you have messages, yes or no? And if you have, you do things, right? So you get 32 messages, but you might not get anything. So what the typical loop is, you sleep for 5 seconds, and then you go and see. It's a polling mechanism. Right.
So you could imagine that these guys have a thing that you can set for an interval that you sleep on. So, again, when we talked about you could have multiple tasks within one worker role, I may want to have my export task sleep for an hour. I only care about exporting out every hour. Right. Whereas in this one, I might want to sleep every 10. I might want to wake up every 10 seconds.
But what happens if you have more than 32 messages? a common mistake is to sleep 5 seconds and then go and get another 32 messages. Right? What you should do is what we're doing here, which is if there still are more messages in the queue, I keep going. Right? Why wait? Right? We've seen that happening many, many times. It's all pre-built in here, so if you use something like this, you will, you know, benefit from all those little best practices. Excellent. All right, so the other thing from a scalability perspective and user experience perspective is that, you know, Windows Azure is a global platform, which means that you have access to a global infrastructure which is, you know, all interconnected, and from Tailspin perspective, you see everything from a single entry point, which is your portal. So you can imagine that something like this could be implemented, right? So you might have a US-based tenant like Adatum, right, creating a survey, but it's a survey which is targeted for European customers, right? So in that case, it might be better to deploy that survey on the European side of Tailspin, get all the results there, and then send the results back to the, you know, core backend where your tenant is affinitized to, right? And that's it's a fairly, you know, straightforward with the architecture that we implemented. It's something that it can be very easily done, right? We haven't implemented it, but all the pieces are in there for you to, you know, evaluate and contemplate an architecture like this.
Oh, now we have to see how many people actually took the survey.
Minutes.
So there's actually, before we look at the survey results, I want to kind of give you a couple of tips and tricks and also show you the actual portal. There we go. So this is, if you were here Monday, I think you showed this. This is the Windows Azure portal. It's pretty straightforward. You can go in, do your account, has all your stuff. But you can see we have a bunch of stuff running up here. So each one of these, if you look at this, this is a compute node. This is a storage node. Looks like a little disk. Looks like a little computer. But you can see that we have all these guys running. When we were running through the application, we have this Tailspin issuers. This is where all the issuers live. This is where Tailspin lives. We have other versions of Tailspin that we're running out here as well. And we also have, this is where the storage is for Tailspin. You can have multiple storage accounts. Remember, you have 100 terabytes of storage. Well, if you have more than 100 terabytes of storage, well, you can have multiple storage accounts. You have to manage your connection strings and things like that. But that's a completely different thing. You'd have to do that if you were sharding your databases as well as that thing. But in this portal, you have your account information. You get to SQL Azure. You can do App Fabric. But if you go out, and let's go up here to Tailspin Storage. This is your, this is where I said down here. Remember, I said we wanted to enable the CDN. Well, there it is. I could just click on this, enable CDN, done. I've now enabled the CDN for my application. Go back to this guy. So this is pretty much the portal, and you can do a lot of things and manage your account that way. Just like Yusuf said this morning as well, there's management APIs to do this. The DPE folks actually put out a bunch of PowerShell scripts that you can use to manage the API. If you've seen the moving apps to the cloud in the lifecycle management portion, that we talk about that. There's other tools. The one I use, just because I do a lot of Azure, is this tool from Cerebrata. I'm not saying you should go out and buy it. But it makes it easy to go out and look at all the tables, your queues, your containers. But I wanted to show you this whole idea behind containers. You can see these are all the tables up here. And these are all the containers. So these containers, remember we talked about when we did all this analytics and things like that, we kind of figure out how to store all this data by just creating containers of things. And we can also do them for particular tenants. So if you have a multi-tenant scenario, you may want to have you may have to separate for legal reasons storage, but we decided not to go down that route. But we do partition the data by a tenant. So we have different things for Adatum. We have different things for Fabricam, and these things get stored in that. And that way, when we're done, we can collect all that information up, and by the fact that we know the slug name and different things like that, we can actually go through and figure out what we're actually working on based on the stuff in the messages in the queue. There's also one more tip I want to offer you, and this one is very important. I don't know how many people were here on Monday with the hands-on labs, but if you run into this problem where you cannot get Azure to start up, and it just gives you weird errors like application domain unloaded, and then you look in the event log, like you think you should be looking for the event log, and it says something about there is a path too long. Yes, Virginia, in Windows, we still have this 256 character limit. You will find that it goes, oh, it's like 260 characters, it's way too long, I can't load this, and it's complaining at IIS, it can't confine this config file and all this other stuff. Long story short, the reason for that is because when you actually deploy or build your cloud application with Visual Studio, it actually creates that in your user directory. So let's just say I'm in users, Scott Den, and then it uses app data, local, and then it's got this other directory, and then it gives it this GUID, and then this long name like deployment ID, blah, blah, blah. Well, eventually, guess what? You're going to run out of characters, and it's not going to load. Probably on your fourth or fifth deployment is about the time it will start dying, because, or I should say your 10th deployment. Because what happens is it goes deployment, it puts a deployment in there, and in parentheses, it puts like the number. So if you look at, I will show you. I promise you, I'm not kidding. Watch this. So, whoops, it's not even, oh, there, excuse me, you can't see it. But see all this? Deployment 350? That's what it puts on your disk. So it's kind of simulating. Remember, you can't get the real Azure environment on your machine, so it kind of simulates all this, and it puts it in this crazy directory structure. Well, if you run into this problem, let me show you what you can do. So there is a environment variable, and you can go to my blog and read more about it, but there is an environment variable. I do everything through PowerShell. I don't like to modify my machine. I like to start up everything and do all my stuff through PowerShell. But this environment variable, which is called underscore csrun underscore state underscore directory, change that to wherever, C colon A. And then every time you actually deploy things, it will get deployed there. So, for example, on my machine, my pretty face there, and we go to, whoops, let's go back. Let's go to drive D in my dev in Azure. You can see this is how it actually stores things. Under S0, under deployment 730, config, and all these little files get created. So now I don't have this path too long problem. If you have a long name, like if they use Scott.Densmore or whatever your name is, put it into your user directory, you'll run into this problem. And you will battle forever and ever trying to figure it out, but that's what that is. And that's why you came to the symposium, to learn that bit of information. Just remember that. Oh, and now we want to see the results. You just want to see the results.
Yes.
Yes! All right, let's log out and log back in. There's 8 Adam.
In the meantime, any questions?
Let's see if anybody actually took the survey.
I think we have lunch afterwards, right? So yeah. We'll be around.
Holy cow. Are you having a good time? 5 of you said no. Leave. And everybody thinks Mickey Mouse is awesome looking. And you're better looking than I am.
That's no surprise.
And Don?
Yo.
You're ugly.
We didn't have another survey to know that.
Yeah, I know. And by the way, this is just funny stuff. We actually built this little word cloud to say, how much, trying to see if there's two Davids, two Bobs. That's an amazing one. And there's two mouses, or four mouses, I should say, two Mickey.
So remember this content, the Tailspin demo and the theory behind everything that we have done, it's in the second guide, which is not the one that you got in print, right? We're still working with the printer to get those in dead trees. So, but all the content is available in MSDN, right? So you can download the entire written content, the entire Tailspin demo, and party with it.
Have fun.
Thank you.